This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 23rd of October 2015 on Monocle 24. Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Gillian Tobias. For this week's film review, I'm joined by Monocle friend and Daily Telegraph film critic, Tim Robey. We'll be kicking things off with the latest Bond blockbuster to hit our screens. Daniel Craig is back as 007 in the 24th film in the franchise, Spectre. Then we'll be heading into the Deep South for a gambling rampage in Mississippi Grind, and we'll get to know the real Marlon Brando in a revealing documentary, Listen to Me, Marlon. That's all to come right here on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. Now, I'm sure there are not many people unaware of the brand new Bond film hitting cinema screens this month. Spectre is the 24th in the Bond franchise and sees Daniel Craig take up the lead role once again, with Sam Mendes in the director's chair for the second time. Tim Robey, welcome to the show. Now, you've seen the film. So many expectations. Does it deliver?
The expectations could hardly be higher than they are after Skyfall. You know, record-breaking box office success that it was. They've brought back Sam Mendes to have another go. What I would say is that this film is sensational entertainment until the opening credits. The pre-credit sequence is one of the best things they've ever done. It's fantastic. It's in Mexico. It's in the Day of the Dead. The first shot is 5 minutes long, and it's this extremely elaborate kind of Birdman-style tracking shot leading us into an action scene. And you really think, wow, they're going for it. They've kind of pushed things. They've pushed about the envelope even further than they did with Skyfall. And then I have to say, from then on, and from the theme song, which is definitely a bit of an issue, from then on, the rest of the film starts to sag a little. I feel it's too long. I feel that the villain is established too late in the day, and that there's a lot of kind of quite draggy exposition in the middle of the movie with too many characters running around. I feel as though they needed a rewrite on this one, basically.
Well, people are definitely going to be rushing to the cinemas because of the expectations. So we're going to hear a little bit of the movie, and then we'll delve into some of the more specific.
Forensics finally released this.
What is it?
Personal effects they recovered from Skyfall. You've got a secret, something you can't tell anyone because you don't trust anyone.
I was at a meeting recently and your name came up.
You're a kite dancing in a hurricane, Mr. Bond.
Welcome, James. It's been a long time. And finally, here we are.
Don't leave now. We'll die together, Mr.
Bond. James. Bond.
A sampler of the new James Bond movie. Now, well, I think that sounds very exciting, I have to say. And I am a Daniel Craig fan for the role of Bond. Fourth time he's taken on the role. Has he grown into it? Does he evolve with the role?
You definitely wouldn't begrudge him this fourth installment. It may well be his final one. He's been sort of hinting as much in interviews. And it's his chance to kind of take off from Skyfall, have his last go at it. I think he's absolutely fine. I think one of the problems is that there's a slight lack of humour to the Enterprise at this point. The writing doesn't give him enough really great one-liners. There are a couple, but they're few and far between. And he doesn't have that knack that actually Roger Moore, for all of his limitations, had of floating a kind of bad joke and making it funny. Daniel Craig's never quite been able to do that. I still think he's actually relaxed into it a little bit here, and the sort of tension of his performance in Skyfall has slightly softened down. I think he's pretty good in it. I think if I have problems that sort of lower down in the cast, I think some of the other cast members are in a way given too much to do. They're running around like the A-team around him. Ralph Fiennes' M is doing a lot more this time. Ben Whishaw's Q. And I feel Bond films are best when they're really tightly scripted and that the action scenes kind of achieve real liftoff. And in this one, for most of the action scenes, I was thinking, oh, it's a bit like the chase scene in The World Is Not Enough down the canal. Or, oh, it's a bit like that car chase. I was reminded constantly of other Bond scenes from the past, which were in some ways superior. So there's a sort of failing of originality in terms of the, you know, the kind of the payoffs, the set pieces. On the other hand, there's something interesting about the movie, and sort of politically, I feel as though Skyfall was quite kind of conservative in a way with a small c. It was getting back to basics. It was putting kind of Bond, putting a man back in the, you know, the head of MI6. It was putting Bond back in the driver's seat. This one is actually slightly anti-Tory, I feel, this film. That one of the kind of subsidiary villains is very much allied with the kind of George Osborne style Tory politics of the moment. And I think that's quite interesting. They're distancing themselves from the current Tory government. They've kind of taken a different step.
Do you think
away.
That's really because the makers of Bond, for a while it was just box office, box office, box office. Now the makers of Bond want the box office, but they also want the accolades and they want the awards and they want the reviews. So they want it to be a smarter franchise.
They do. They want a level of sophistication. They want that kind of kudos. I think it's all done a little bit heavy-handedly to really garner them that. I think it works totally. It functions totally on a kind of commercial level. It will do very well commercially. I don't think it's going to have kind of lasting impact with people. I don't think the critics are necessarily going to kind of come back to it and say, look how clever that was. Some of the gambits it's trying just feel a little bit dated. I'm really very strictly avoiding spoilers here, but there's a sort of reveal with the villain, which is a type of reveal with the villain that we've seen in other franchises a lot lately. And I feel as though they've just copied from those certain Marvel and comic book blockbuster type franchises is what I've got in mind. So it's copying things too much. It's copying itself too much. I think this was a chance for them, in a way, to strike out in a brand new direction after enormous success last time. And I feel as though instead they've retrenched, basically.
Well, Spectre will be released in the UK and Ireland on October 26th, before rolling out globally as of November, so not long to wait. Let's move on now to Mississippi Grind, the story of Jerry, a gambler on a downward spiral who hopes to turn his luck around when he befriends a young gambler called Curtis. The two, played by Ben Mendelsohn and Ryan Reynolds, head off on a road trip in an attempt to win back all that they've lost. Now, this is being compared to Robert Altman's 1974 film, California Split. Even the movie posters, I gather, are quite similar. Tim, is this just an update of that film, or do we have a new kind of storyline and theme?
It's a contemporary riff on that kind of film, which is, you know, a sort of a buddy movie about two inveterate gamblers who find each other and kind of enable each other try and, you know, have another few rolls of the dice, basically. But I think it's given enough of a kind of contemporary spin. And I think that the casting is really good. I love it as a character piece, this film. Ben Mendelsohn has just been on a roll lately. Australian actor who really, I think, started from about Animal Kingdom 5 years ago to gain these really excellent roles in Hollywood movies where he usually plays the most broken, dangerous, difficult character on screen. And here he's a wreck. I mean, he's a gambling addict. He never knows when to quit. And he's heavily in debt. He's got a broken marriage. He's got a daughter he doesn't have any relationship with. And Ryan Reynolds' character is this kind of younger, more energetic, more confident guy who sort of enables him and gets him on the road. But we're wondering all the way through, is he a good influence or a bad influence? Where's he going to drag him? What's going to be the outcome here? So there's enough tension in the relationship there. They have to keep winning to stay together, but they don't do a lot of winning as it goes along. I really love the locations in this film as well. The trip down the Mississippi, down into the South is beautifully caught. I think the direction's excellent. It's not heavy on plot. It's not the kind of movie where there's just one big game that they're heading towards, where everything hinges on that. It's a kind of rambling experience, but I think there's enough between the two of those actors. Ryan Reynolds really good in it too, that there's loads to grapple with.
Well, let's have a listen. This is a clip from the film Mississippi Grind.
Next time you quit when I tell you it's time.
Some guys are born to lose.
What do you want, Jerry? Tell me. Hit me. 1, 2, 3, lay it on me. Boom!
I just can't catch a break. I just can't win.
The story doesn't have a happy ending, Jerry. I think you should go back home.
Can't go back empty-handed. I can't do that. We're in it together.
What's he need the money for?
He believes that it will set him free.
A hero is nothing more than the guy who pulls off what the rest of us are scared to do.
I'd spend it all double or nothing.
Yeah, bet it all.
An excerpt from the film Mississippi Grind. Now, you spoke about the acting. Tell us a little bit about the soundtrack.
Oh, there's tremendous stuff in here. Yeah, there's really great blues numbers. There's a kind of stonking score all the way through. It really propels the movie forward. I really like the filmmaking team behind this movie. They made Half Nelson, which was the Ryan Gosling kind of junkie teacher film from 2006 that he got an Oscar nomination for. They're interested in the kind of flip side of the American dream in a way. They're interested in people who have failed. They're interested in failure and they're interested in addiction. And this is very much about gambling addiction. It's about that being so into this game that you cannot conceive of stopping playing. No matter how much you've won, you're about to bet it all again and probably lose it all again. And this guy has basically allowed his entire life to be sucked into this kind of black hole that is poker addiction.
And do they have a point of view?
Do they have a point of view?
On gambling?
I don't think it's judgmental. I think it views it in the same way that probably they viewed heroin addiction in a way. You can see the highs of it. It shows you the highs. It also shows you the brutal lows, and it shows you the kind of mess, the wreckage he's made of his life. There's a scene where he kind of stops in on his ex-wife, who has no idea why she's visiting, where he's visiting her. And before we know it, he's rifling through her sock drawer looking for the money that he knows she keeps stashed there because he's completely desperate. And we get this... that's her only scene, but we kind of have a total sense of how their marriage played out from that scene. So it's in a way quite bleak stuff. But I think the actors have so much charisma, and Ben Mendelsohn plays losers so beautifully. He's such a detailed actor. Ryan Reynolds, interesting, because I think his blockbuster choices have never really panned out. And you know, he's probably a man who's been through, you know, more agents than most of us have had hot dinners. But in this kind of context, playing something gritty and real, I think he's an actor of real versatility, and his charisma does actually kind of really drive it along.
Well, Mississippi Grind has been released in the USA, UK, Ireland and Lithuania. So if you are there, do look out for it. We're going to finish today's show with a new documentary, Rich in Rare Footage, that depicts the life of screen legend Marlon Brando. The film is called Listen to Me, Marlon, and was directed by Stephen Riley. Tim, there are no talking heads in this documentary, but rather it relies on original footage and voice recordings of Marlon Brando. How does it hold together?
Yeah, the closest thing to a talking head that we get is actually Marlon Brando himself as a sort of digitized 3D rendition of himself. This was done in the 1980s. A visual effects guy basically did a rendering of his head and had him talking to camera saying, they've done this thing, they've digitized my head. So we have him saying that to us, which is very disconcerting. It's like a ghost coming back to deliver his story at the beginning. And then for the rest of the film, it's all taken from interviews, outtakes, private tape recordings that he made. So it's all in Brando's own words. And we go through, basically, from the very beginning. We go through from his kind of days training under Stella Adler through the kind of rocky ups and downs of his Hollywood career and then out the other side to the kind of tragic stuff that happened with his family in later life. It's quite loosely organized because obviously they've plucked whatever the best stuff is they can get from all these different sources. The sense of narrative through his life is in a way slightly lacking, I think, but there's a lot of very interesting kind of thematic and almost poetic links that it makes between, you know, different musings that he has on his work and his art and thoughts on politics and thoughts on civil rights and all kinds of stuff that he got involved in.
Well, let's hear what that sounds like.
When what you are is unwanted, then you look for an identity that will be acceptable. A good con man can fool anybody. The first person that you fool was yourself. I feel as though I'm coming closer to what it means to be human. You are the memories.
Hit them, knock them over. With an attitude, with a word, with a look.
Everybody feels like they're a failure. Everybody feels they could have been a contender.
A clip from the new documentary, Listen to Me, Marlon. Quite moving there. Do you think that there must be something very heady about, after the death of such an iconic actor, to hear them speak about their life and their work? Is it revealing, surprising in any way?
It is. I mean, it gets us closer to his sort of inner life than any other treatment I've seen or read about Brando. There's a sense of a man who really thought very hard about every decision he made. Nothing was taken lightly, even though he ended up making some kind of dubious choices just for the money. And in fact, later in his career, you know, notoriously would have cue cards placed on the other actors' faces because he couldn't really be bothered to read the lines. But that in a way was because he cared so much about acting that he knew when he was doing that kind of payday job, that wasn't acting. That wasn't truth that he was conveying anymore. That was just something almost like doing an advert. And the real depth and breadth of his earlier career was when he invested himself completely in these roles and lived and breathed them. Streetcar Named Desire, On the Waterfront, Last Tango in Paris, and The Godfather in the 70s. And this very special talent he had for managing to sort of dig right down into the heart of those characters. He explains this to us. He explains why acting is important to him and why the kind of dubious sham of like sort of doing a bit part in a big commercial movie to him is a very different kettle of fish. So he didn't invest so much in that.
There have been some amazing biographies, documentaries recently, Amy Winehouse, Nina Simone. And I think what is so incredible and so powerful is the actual raw footage, archive footage that hasn't been seen before. And again, it is that truth is almost stronger than fiction.
I feel that. And I feel in his later years, the great Brando performance that we perhaps weren't given is the one he was giving us himself, you know, when he was responding to the terrible scenarios in his family. His son Christian was imprisoned for murder and his daughter committed suicide. And we see the kind of courtroom scenes of him having to deal with this stuff. And he breaks down and he becomes almost like a child again. You watch it happen. And you sort of get this depth of emotion in the guy. There was just something, he was very, very close to his emotions. I think that's what's clear from this. And everything that he tells us, we feel as though it's coming from a fairly deep place. And it's very gratifying to see all of this stuff brought to life. I think there are other places you could go to for a more sort of detailed blow-by-blow account of kind of how his career fluctuated, for instance. But this is a very interesting kind of an immersive experience in the life of Brando.
Listen to Me, Marlon premiered at the Sundance Film Festival at the beginning of this year and was released in American cinemas over the summer months. It's out now in the UK, and look out for the DVD next month if you're in other territories around the world. Well, that brings us to the end of today's show. Tim Robey, thanks very much as always for joining us in studio. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Gillian DeBias, and my producer was Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time on Monday when we'll be looking at the week in art. For now, thanks very much for listening.